Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And we need to continue learn, pray, and act. And we've got Sean with us today. Welcome back, Sean. And we're kind of getting through a clip here of the Bill of Rights. We already covered pretty much the First Amendment, getting ready to dive into the Second Amendment. Now, I typically like to make comment that we learn a lot from amendments that didn't get passed. There are some amendments that we're going to address here that are a part of the Bill of Rights that are real sleepers. Now, the Second Amendment, I don't know about you, but you probably know a lot of people in the Second Amendment movement of protecting their right to have guns and so forth. I mean, it's probably equally big in Louisiana as it is in most every state, right?
Oh, I would say so.
All right. So, 9 times out of 10, it always equates to the right to bear arms. Now, I got to do a go back, because the Second Amendment points to the very first thing, and I'll go ahead and read that, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. Now, that's not a semicolon, that's a comma, but I'm going to take a break, because we need to understand this importance, because the national defense system is the militia. It's not a part-time enforcement in defense and so forth. It is a national, all times we need to be training, disciplining. You know, everybody needs to understand that they have a responsibility. As a matter of fact, when we hit the Third Amendment, I'm going to actually show you a level of compulsion that the federal government had, because the federal government wasn't to have a whole bunch of big, huge installations in defending America. Interestingly enough, we can kind of garner that they weren't to create. But again, I understand technology and being able to defend oneself and moving away from the old muskets and mortars and artillery, you know, the old revolutionary weaponry into modern weaponry. So I understand that we needed to grow the militia accordingly, not empower this, what Eisenhower called the military-industrial complex, to where we were basically pushing ourselves or poking our nose into businesses so that we could continually throw money into the defense industry. Now, let's just step back again, like I said, and let me look at Article 1, Section 8. And in so doing, this is where we actually find the militia coming in. Now, it starts off with, to raise and support armies, but no appropriation of money to that use shall be for a longer term than 2 years. So when it says to raise and support armies, the whole point of this isn't giving them the power to do that. As a matter of fact, the power to do that comes down into subsection 14. This is subsection 11. So this is basically saying, hey, if you're going to call forth the militia to create this army, then you need to do so by appropriation of money, so that you can cap the spending for no more than 2 years. They wanted to make sure that they didn't create a perpetual army where they would have, you know, regular army folks gathering a check, getting retirement, and creating a career out of being, you know, in the federal army. They wanted to maintain, you know, keep that cost down, and they wanted to also ensure that the federal government wasn't gaining more and more power. Remember, the states created this federal government in a with. Let's just keep it this way. The paradigm of the states were they wanted to ensure that this government was limited and was maintained in a very tight bottle, that they didn't let this genie out. Now, getting into the 14th power, or subsection 14, I should say, they shall have the power to call forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, or repel invasions. So in other words, for them to create this army, these were the three justifications that they felt would be sufficient to create the army. Nothing more, just this. In other words, you know, hey, our good friends and family back in Europe are being harassed by, you know, some people that speak, you know, different, and we want to go defend them. That's not here. There's no reason why we would ever deploy the army off of U.S. soil. All three of these requirements for the justifications for creating the army are all focused on actually doing things within the boundaries of the United States. So the next part right here is the critical part that links, and actually this lays the foundation for the Second Amendment. To provide, so the Congress shall have the power. It's a role, responsibility, power, standard that they have, but it's listed in the power, so we identify this as a power. To provide for organizing the army, organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia. They're to provide for that. So when we look at the organizing and the disciplining, now, Sean, you have served in the Army, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so thank you for your service. And I, when I ever hear that, it just really bothers me, because 9 times out of 10, as a service member to a service member, I don't like to actually be asked to stand up so that they could feel better by clapping because they're recognizing us, right? I feel like, you know, they're, you know, I'm giving them an out for not really supporting us.
Right.
Because, oh, well.
I feel you.
Right? Even at a sporting event, a pro baseball game, because I've gone to some pro baseball games where they would actually have the military stand up and everybody would clap and, you know, like, okay, that's all we need to do to show we love them and support them. No. Now, I don't know when you joined, but I joined a long time ago where my deuce gear was spears and swords and so forth, and deuce gear being, you know, your war gear. And I'm just kidding, but I joined when the contract stated that if you do 20 years, you retire in 20 years, your medical and dental is free. Now, they're not honoring that contract. As a matter of fact, it costs, you know, I look at those who I served with that did not go and get an education, maybe didn't have the same capacity, didn't, you know, what have you, and they were far more dependent on the government actually living up to that. As a matter of fact, I've really tried to keep myself out of, you know, the VA and any of that, because I don't want to be a further burden on the government. Now, as I look at, you know, all of these people that I knew, that I've known, and that there's lots of people, folks, that are still alive that have been lied to. I shouldn't say they've been lied to. Basically, Congress has said, you know what, we're not honoring our word. That's exactly what it is. So, I got down a rat hole here, but I hate when people just say, you know, thank you for your service. If you really want to thank me, you need to basically start standing up and saying, hey, we need to revisit all of the labor contracts that you've put out for all of those people that are in the military, because you need to be honoring those, period. We need the people to actually stand up and say, hey, give them what you promised. Quit, you know, taking out of the, you know, these people joined on these very specific things. And actually, when I joined, we just started this brand new concept of a full voluntary military. Before that, they had the draft. And oh, by the way, the federal government had no authority to actually conduct a draft. It says right here that they shall call forth the militia. In other words, they're not going to manage every individual and control you as a part of before you actually start serving. The point was that the states were supposed to actually, and this is part of 15, to provide for art. This is Congress's role and responsibility, to provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia, and for governing such part of them as be employed in the service of the United States, then reserving to the states respectively. So now this is what the states are supposed to do. They're supposed to appoint the officers, and they have the authority of training the militia according to the discipline prescribed by Congress. So in other words, it's their job to execute the training. It's Congress's job to pay for it. It's their job to, you know, to ensure we're disciplined. In other words, a discipline, and I'm sure in the Army you did your, you know, field training and, you know, exercises. When I say exercises, folks, I don't mean going out and doing calisthenics. We actually go out and exercise a war plan to where, you know, we're supposed to hit the beach, knock out these, you know, I'll just call them objectives or what have you. And, you know, sometimes we play force on force, but 9 times out of 10, we don't do that just because it costs money. And maybe once a year we'll do a force on force, and we're not using rounds or anything else. But anyway, the point is that the states are supposed to do this. What the military has been doing all along, the states are supposed to do it, and the money is supposed to be coming from the federal government. So now we look at the Second Amendment, and the Second Amendment, as it states, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Now, let me go back to the preamble. The preamble as Madison stated, it is a bunch of declaratory restrictive clauses that are being added, super added upon, and it's like a restriction being super added to the federal government in the Constitution to say, you can't do these things. So when they say that this Second Amendment and the right to bear arms shall not be infringed, is that an individual right and privilege, or is that a responsibility of the citizens to be a part of the national defense system?
I would say the second.
So when we look at the 14th Amendment, now let's just, you know, we'll mosey down to the 14th Amendment just real quick. And the 14th Amendment states that no state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States. Does that mean members of the organizations of the militias in each state?
No.
And this goes down where I talk about in the First Amendment. The First Amendment protects the citizens' privileges and immunities with the freedom of the press, freedom of speech, freedom of religion. But it doesn't mean that the state can't create its own church and use that church for very specific purposes such as education, so that they don't do it. So they basically leave it to the church to do that. Now, all the states got away from doing that, but after the Constitution was ratified and after the Bill of Rights was ratified, how many states joined the Union and actually created a self-sponsored church? Kentucky did it. Tennessee did it. I'm pretty sure that when Vermont did, you know, came in, I believe they did as well. It was very common. Why? Because the Bill of Rights restrictions placed upon the federal government. In other words, in many of the states, and Madison even argued this during the debates of the Bill of Rights, that many states didn't have militias. They didn't have bills of rights. And as a matter of fact, there were states in the Union that actually restricted gun ownership. So when everybody says, hey, you can't do that, well, I hate to say this, but what we need to get to a point, because let me just put it to you this way. If America actually implemented the militia system the way it was supposed to, and we got rid of all of the mercenary force systems, your state police, your city police, and everything else, and the sheriff and the militia were functioning properly where they were executing the laws of the Union and the laws of the state and the laws of the county and the laws of the city, therefore the city would be paying the sheriff for maintaining whatever's necessary, but the sheriff would actually have to integrate. So he would have probably a few full-time players that, you know, because of their capabilities, whatever they get promoted, just because they've proven themselves to, you know, be able to do, learn, and get on top of things. But everybody else has to do the, you know, the second partner ride along, whatever, right? And they have to, you know, come up on active duty for a month here, a couple of weeks there, and take a break from their job. But everybody in the county, if you have that kind of county where you've got a crime problem, let me just say this. If everybody is responsible for enforcing the law and everybody is armed that's a part of the militia, in other words, you have your sidearm that while you're not on duty, that's your own personal sidearm, just like law enforcement, and everybody was required to maintain their sidearms on them, then I'm betting if you go into the statistics of every community that has done that, where they've required sidearms for everybody, every citizen, the crime rate goes down dramatically, especially what we call victim crimes, you know, robberies and assaults and those types of things. They go down dramatically. So I would believe that shoplifting and that type of stuff, even the, you know, the little misdemeanor type of crimes would go down because you don't have to look for a policeman, and actually you can't, because you yourself are probably a part of that militia. And if you commit a crime, see, this gets into this concept of a well-regulated militia. I don't believe that if you've committed a crime, you should be able to be in good status in the militia. How do you feel about that?
I don't see how you would be trustworthy to defend
there you,
if you're a criminal.
Right, and so, but you still had this responsibility, because if you, let's look at it this way, because, you know, people can game, and people game very quickly when they find out, I can do this. So you create that kind of situation, then people that don't want to be in the military, all they do is just go out and commit a crime. Misdemeanor, what have you, okay, I'm not in the military anymore. Oh, okay, I don't care to have a gun. They're probably cowards, what have you. They just want to make themselves ineligible to be a part of the militia. And so I think that, you know, you have to do, you know, instead of doing time in a jail, you have to, you know, do some duty. You know, whether it's doing the night shift, you know, cleaning up the sheriff's offices, whatever. But I believe that, you know, if you commit a crime, then instead of actually going into jail, depending on what the type of crime is, but if you just committed a crime to kind of try to game the system, then you would be just put to, like, indentured service or what have you. The point is a well-regulated militia means that it is integrated into society, that everybody is a part of it. That was the whole concept. These men understood this divine nature of making everybody a citizen in the state, in the county, in the city, and everybody being held accountable to doing their duty. As a matter of fact, when you read some of the laws, and as a matter of fact, when you read the Oath of Citizen, and if you go far enough down, there's points in time when somebody, a competent authority, comes to you, they can confiscate your car, and you need to assist, or they call upon you to assist in some manner. That all is a very dynamic situation that we all need to be ready for. We're all supposed to be ready. And the fact that they've been ignoring the militia all of this time literally proves the fact that they have undermined this Constitution, this entire system. And the people that have been doing this are those who have not been paying. So if there's anything that we need to have a actual school academy thing for in every county, would be for the militia. And you don't have to have it, you know, it can be shared across counties because it's all state level. But the point is that when we look at a well-regulated militia, these guys that run around and say, you know, I want to have all these guns and I want to, yeah, those are yours if you're in the militia. If you're not in the militia, then I don't think you should be trusted with a gun. What about those people who do not have the mental capacity to be trusted with a gun? Can you take away their rights under the Constitution? Absolutely. If you have a well-regulated militia, does that make sense? As a matter of fact, let me ask you this. Did you get a chance to go through grenade trainings or familiarization, where they call it fan fire or whatever? You know, they put a live grenade in your hand and you get to throw it. Did you do things like that?
Yes, sir. I actually served in combat in Desert Storm.
Okay, great, great. Okay, so did they, when they were giving you the initial training in basic training, did they, you know, identify guys that they wouldn't put a hand grenade in their hands?
Yeah, they were most definitely vetting.
Yes. Okay, so.
And you could tell that there was a very serious situation.
Yeah, yeah. So in the Marine Corps.
More so than the range.
Yeah, so in the Marine Corps, when we went to combat arms training in boot camp, where we got to do fan fire with, you know, hand grenades and so forth. The drill instructors went along the backs of everybody and wrote an S, I should say, not on everybody, but those people they didn't trust, they put an S on them. And so those people in the platoon did not get a chance to actually hold a live grenade and throw it. They were given a grenade, but it wasn't live, and they were able to, you know, throw it, but these guys just didn't want to see, you know, these depressed kids. Now, you got to remember, this is a voluntary force. A few years before this, when it was the draft, there were guys that just did not want to be there. They were actually, you know, became suicidal because they were scared to death of having to go to war.
And we actually had a guy in our unit when we got the orders to go to Kuwait that he attacked his roommate with a pair of scissors, and we had to physically accost him.
Yeah, and he probably went to jail, got kicked out, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so he got out of doing what he needed to do, but let's look at the system we're supposed to have. You're not going to go to war. We're calling you up to do something very specific. In other words, we're not sending you to some foreign soil to get killed. We're actually defending, and we're doing everything we can to make sure you survive and everybody else survives, and we don't lose anything. It's our defense system. And that's, to me, that's a completely different paradigm, because it's not like we're actually going to be deployed to, you may be deployed to another state, a border state, something like that, or, you know, to a town or area where there's a lot of rioting because they have, you know, progressive education that is, you know, basically indoctrinating kids to uprise and become communist and become treasonous, you know, in their behavior. Fact of the matter is, if you really think about implementing the militia system as designed by the framers, what they should have done, and the reason that they didn't, I don't mean to give George Washington and all of the presidents at the very beginning of our republic a pass, but the reason why they just never really focused in developing a true militia system and the Navy was because we were under threat of this big, huge empire that was still dominating the world called Britain. And it wasn't until 1812. Well, anyway, we're going into break. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
All right, so Sean, let me bring you into this, because I don't mean to, you know, just talk. And, you know, at any point in time, if you've got an idea, you want to just throw something out there, by all means, you're more than welcome to do that. So what are your thoughts, though? I mean, you're hearing something regarding the Constitution, the militia, that I'm just out on this limb, maybe, that you've never heard this before.
I have not heard that idea before, but it makes a lot of sense. The first thing that comes to my mind is, in nowadays, in the time we're living in, how would you manage the sheer amount and volume of crime? If we were to disband the police entities, like in my area, every little incorporated town has a police department. The parishes have sheriff's departments, state troopers. If you could get rid of all of that and rely on a voluntary force, it would be called up. We would have some serious problems.
So I believe that you can't. So I'm not sure. I know you have IT background. And so if you have a plan of making a major change in your corporate, you know, internet, your corporate infrastructure, you're changing out computers, you're going to a new OS, you're going to a whole new networking system and storage. I mean, you're doing this big, major change. Now, anybody listening to this can say, my company does it badly. They, you know, we're always impacted because nobody's ever happy, because doing something like that is, you know, I don't want to marginalize open heart surgery, but when you have a system that is functioning at a, you know, in a company practically 24/7, you don't get downtime. To take downtime, as a matter of fact, the way we look at it, you know, in management side, when I have employees that can't do anything, then I'm paying them to be non-productive, completely non-productive. So you have to kind of plan it with, you know, a major education where everybody has to go get their corporate, you know, education, like not to be sexually hostile or that type of stuff. But you try to tie all these things together so that you minimize the effect of downtime and productivity and still make sure the company mission and all the other things that can get done. But nevertheless, you just never do, you know, you just don't jump off the cliff and say, okay, we got rid of that, now we got to put this new thing in. Now you got to design it. You got to figure out exactly how you're going to phase that in so seamlessly that most people don't realize that something changed. I think that's the way to do this. And I think that when you look at the municipality, like let's just say a city police force, right? Obviously that city, and a good case in point is Atlanta, because it's a real quagmire. How many counties does the city of Atlanta reside in? Do you know?
No, sir.
See, now, Seattle resides in one county. Atlanta resides in, I don't know, if you pull up a map of the counties of Georgia, since you have the internet and you're pretty quick at doing that, when you pull up that map and you look at the counties of Georgia, and then you look at the city of Atlanta, it spreads across, I'm going to probably say 40 29. Counties?
29.
How many?
29.
Okay, 30, basically. So that's a lot. In other words, when you break down the police force, the city police force, but you realize that the city police force doesn't operate out of one building and one headquarters. They have these districts. And so each county would then transition to become a district of the law enforcement at the sheriff's department, and it would transition over, and some of these guys, you know, would either be retiring or they would be going into reserve status. In other words, they would have to get another job if they, you know, if they were no longer needed. So the whole point is, as you start to move these guys over, well, you got a citizenry that hasn't been trained yet. Okay, so you now need your state legislature as a part of all this process to make sure the funding is started to coming in from D.C., stopping the unconstitutional money coming in, and basically taking that money that is coming in and saying, okay, this is what we're going to use for educating everybody that right now is 16 or 15 years of age and up to 60. Everybody's going to have to start getting training, and we're going to have to mandate that employers give their folks time off. And or we have to kind of like jury duty, right?
Right.
Because we have to look at this as a civil responsibility that, you know, whether sometimes employers will pay for your time off in contributing to, you know, the needs of the community. Sometimes, and actually, when we really start looking at a self-government, it's a lot more than just a little bit of jury duty here and there. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Because we need to be driving what we need for infrastructure at a citizen level, not letting bureaucrats and planners go and work with the World Economic Forum to say, well, this is what we want you to do. That doesn't work out well in America. And as a matter of fact, it's really pushing us off the cliff. So either we have a self-governing system or we go into the arms of the globalists. And I think most people would rather actually feel a little bit more important to start participating at a county level in all of these different functions that you may want your county government to be doing. Now, this goes down to what we're doing with petitions. And so it's a great opportunity to sell the importance of these First Amendment petitions, because what we're doing is we're preparing the county to move in a direction to become constitutional. Well, what are the things that a county needs to do to become a constitutional county? Well, first off, you got to have a constitution, right? You have to actually figure out what you want that government to do. Because remember, governments get their authority from constitutions. And constitutions are created to basically support the needs of the people. So it's created by we the people, especially at that county level. So do we want them to have a healthcare system? Or do we want them to regulate a healthcare system? Do we, you know, what level, you know, of intrusions do we want our government to have in our everyday life? And as a matter of fact, remember that a lot of these things were managed by what? Years ago. When you look at healthcare, education, welfare systems, and so forth, who managed that?
The church.
There you go. So guess what? We're going to have to now tap on the shoulders of the church. And, oh, hey, by the way, now the government's not going to be doing it as a compulsion, and they're not going to have these manipulative social engineers in your community telling you you got to do this and you got to do this because that's what the bureaucracy has created for you, right? So they go away. these social engineers, what we call them, social services, social administration. All of that stuff was an implementation of socialism, where government was going to control every facet of our lives. They go away. You got to get another job. Get a job that is actually, you know, something that you can put food on the table here in America. You know, like grow your own food or learn a trade or what have you. But what we would see is that all these social engineers would go away. Most of these responsibilities would actually go back to the people that we should be trusting anyway. I know that they themselves have equally been corrupted in many cases. So it's a problem. But we have to, because this comes up every once in a while. You know, when you talk about actually holding people fully accountable and these types of things, that we need to actually make these transitions. And if this happens way too many times, where I hear somebody come back and say, hey, if we actually started using Section 3 and holding public servants accountable to their oath of office, then we wouldn't have Congress. We would basically have to get rid of all of Congress. And I disagree. Now, I believe that that paradigm means that we're incapable. That means that basically our society is incapable of doing the right thing. No, I believe that when you give anybody room enough, they will game. There's a great book out there that's called Who Moved My Cheese? It's a very short book. I think the foreword was done by Ken Blanchard. And it talks about, you know, the average people are out there gaming and they're out there getting free cheese because we created a system that gives away cheese. And so when the cheese goes away here, it then has to show up somewhere else. If there's nobody just giving away cheese, then guess what? You have to start making your own cheese. You have to, you know, start actually doing something and applying yourself instead of being a, what we'll call a parasite, or, you know, this. Now, there are folks that they're not parasites because they're elderly, they're infirm, they're incapable of doing things for themselves. Well, the church is going to take care of them. But let me stop right where I am right here with this and inject this into your paradigm. We're no longer paying the salaries and the retirement programs for all of these social engineers, all these manipulators of the federal bureaucracy. It's all gone. The environment people, they're gone. It doesn't mean that we're not going to have a clean environment or want to have one. It just means the responsibility shift, and we're going to start doing things right in a self-governing system. And so that means that people will have to actually contribute. But guess what? The money we pay in taxes goes away. Remember, I say that debt is fraud, that spending? What would the federal spending be if they actually got the Department of Defense back into the bottle it's supposed to be per the Constitution? All these things go away that aren't supposed to exist. All these laws, regulate, they all go away. So now you're free in your state to start doing anything possible and utilizing your resources, because the federal government's not saying you can't use those resources. You can't cut your trees down. You can't go over there and do that. Now you actually are unfettered. And now they're not taking everything out of your pocket. So where does that money now go? Well, actually, where did the money come from? When we had to start paying taxes, there was a major drop in contributions to church, contributions to God. People stopped contributing. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
And so there's very few people that, you know, because I know Christians that are trying to pay an honest tithe. They want to pay a full 10% or what have you. And it's almost impossible. And that's one of the reasons why almost every household is a two-income household. Because they got kids, and the inflation and everything else, and the enslavery at the corporation level, the way they've basically got us down to minimum discretionary spending, you know, and people always spend, you know, money they shouldn't be spending on going to sports events and the parties and you know, having the variety. People, actually way too many people, I think it's like 80%, if not greater, live from hand to mouth. In other words, they have no savings, and they are probably carrying more debt than they really should be, and that they're literally, the day they lose their job, they jump into that safety net, just like that. And so this is a problem in our paradigm. But I believe when things start changing, because I think when people start going back to church, when they start paying tithe, and they start doing, you know, contributing and being a part of our society and our self-governing system, then I believe that we'll actually start seeing this, you know, the thing that the framers saw, where they saw humanity was a beautiful thing. I used to, you know, I always say this, but I, you know, don't say it that often, so I have to say, I used to say that the best thing about, you know, life here on this planet are the people. We, the people, are the greatest thing, because we were created in His image. And when we see people doing things, you know, in compassion and reaching out to help others and those types of things, it just, you know, it becomes an ineffable thing for, you know, how do you express the words necessary for the compassion that somebody's done for somebody, you know, selflessness, you know, even in war, where somebody will jump on a grenade to save everybody else. Those types of things, words fail in expressing one's appreciation. The fact of the matter is that should be a standard of our humanity or our society. And so anyway, I got into more of a philosophical bent on the Second Amendment, but let me get into the next amendment. Bottom line is, folks, as departing this, we all have a responsibility. And this next amendment actually helps understand that when necessary, when the federal government is calling forth the militia, this third amendment goes in hand. 9 times out of 10, when you read this amendment, nobody understands why this amendment is here. It's because we are the national force, which means that our homes, houses, and our property is a part of the defense system. Go ahead and read this one.
Two?
Yeah, three, please.
Three. Uh-huh. No soldier shall, in time of peace, be quartered in any house without the consent of the owner, nor in time of war, but in a manner to be prescribed by law. Originating in the House of Representatives and Congress, with just compensation per the Fifth Amendment.
Okay, so that little parenthesis, I believe, you know what? I think that might have been something added by me, and I want to catch myself at that. So let me look for the Bill of Rights, or you can look for the Bill of Rights and go, yeah, hey, GR, that's something you did. So let me see here.
Is that the annotated Constitution?
Well, so I'm just looking for the Bill of Rights, the National Archives. That will actually... No, I mean,
is yours the new annotated, the GR annotated version?
Yeah. Okay, so this is the resolve, blah, 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 the 8th article, the 11th. That's... the Bill of Rights Institute, the Ten Amendments. And so let me see here. As I look at the Second Amendment, the Third Amendment, it says, no soldier shall in time of law or time of peace be quartered in any house without the consent of the owner, nor time of war, but in manner to be prescribed by law. So what is added there, and I need to probably, I'll have to change that bracket to a bracket, instead of a parenthesis, because that is created by me. And the reason I inserted this, and I'll have to change the text to something different. So the reason I inserted this, folks, and I thought I did, is that you need to understand that when when the spending of a bill. So it says right here that nor in time of war. So in other words, Congress has to actually give this consent. And that means that you can't just be taken. They can't take property, because when you get to the Fifth Amendment, it says no property shall be seized without the owner's consent and without just compensation, right, for public purposes. So in other words, they can't come in and they can take your barn and start quartering soldiers out there and convert it into, you know, a barracks or what have you. Because why? Because we had no idea who was ever going to plan on attacking us, and they didn't want to have the nation spend all of the money in creating these huge fortresses and so forth, that the intent was that we all had skin in the game in doing what was necessary for the quartering of people as well as taking up arms. So, again, the point is that when they actually pass this by law, a bill has to originate out of the House of Representatives, because that's what Congress, or that's what the Constitution demands, that the Senate cannot originate any spending bills for the appropriation of money and so forth. And the other part is that they, when they actually confiscate your property, you're to be justly compensated per the Fifth Amendment. Now, let me add this. When you look at just compensation, right, that nine times out of ten, the cost in controversy, in other words, when they take your barn, it's probably going to cost more than $20. Therefore, the Seventh Amendment also kicks in, because when it comes down to basically determining whether they're going to give you just compensation or not, they can't just come along and say, we're going to give you this much, because that's what we give everybody. Well, hold on here. My barn is much bigger than everybody else's, or my barn is smaller. You know, not too many people would point those things out. They'd be happy to get what everybody else gets. The point is that as the Seventh Amendment says, in cases of common law where the controversy is greater than $20, I'm just paraphrasing, it comes off pretty good because you just remember these things. But bottom line, because if the controversy greater than $20, the trial by jury shall be preserved. In other words, we don't let the judge or the government tell us what we're going to get. When it comes to just compensation, to be compensated for something, that means that you have, especially if it's over $20, then you have a right to have your case pled to a jury of your peers, so that because everybody knows, you know, how much that property meant to you, especially if you were taking care of it and so forth. I mean, those people that didn't even try, you know, they inherited it, they bought it, they just let it, you know, go to ruins, they were just running it down. Okay, then that person's probably not going to get, you know, a great reward, and the jury's not going to see that he needs that much in compensation. But the people who have been taking care of it, they have this intrinsic values, blah, blah, blah. The point is that we have gotten into the mode of accepting what a judge is going to tell us what it's worth. And right here's one of those things that kind of starts creating all these other links. All of these links are significant, and they're actually interconnected. When you look at the power, Article 1, Section 8, and the militia, I've connected those dots to you. All of these things, you know, became the incident. It's basically the artifact that is begotten from something, and that's what some of these amendments are. These amendments are actually here because they know that if we actually had to go to war, then there's going to be a likelihood of quartering. We're going to have to deploy troops out of these other states to along the coastline of the East Coast, from the interior to the East Coast. And so where are we going to put them? We're going to have to put them in people's barns and, you know, in homes and so forth. And that's the whole point of having this amendment, basically saying that they won't do this, but they can if they have to. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir. And how much does it have to do with what the British did when they were trying to stifle the revolution and colonial dissent?
Yeah, so you got to remember that the British Empire did not recognize private property, right? Everything was for the king. I mean, technically, the king could preserve, you know, anything he wanted if he wanted to, but if he didn't, he wouldn't. And so the quartering of troops and so forth, there was no just compensation. This is one of the reasons why that amendment was actually put in, is the Seventh Amendment, that just compensation would be done, or it would be handled so that, you know, you actually got, you know, a true value for your loss instead of letting them say, well, this is what we're going to give you. So I hope I answered your question. Did I answer your question?
Yes, sir. You did.
Yeah, probably.
I mean, it harkens back to a couple of things I've seen, like I said before, in movies. But like when they talk about, oh, we're bringing this kid to the king or the whoever it was because he shot one of the king's deers.
Mm, yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Because
everything belongs to the king.
Yeah. And he'll share that if he feels magnanimous, if he feels, you know, yeah, like you're worthy. Right. But if not, then the king had the ability to oppress his own people, which is why they had to come up with the Magna Carta, which is why they had to come up with the glorious Bill of Rights. And down the road, they'll come and see. This is why the system that we had was so superior. We only gave our government the ability to do these very few things. Not, you know, hey, figure it out and just do what you need to, you know, rule us by your discretion. Because that's what a general power of attorney does. You decide what to do and how to do it. This Constitution tells them what they have to do and how to do it, and it contains them into that. They can't do anything not listed. And the 10th Amendment actually secures that. Even though the Constitution doesn't say that, throughout the ratification debates, they said it, they said it, and they said it. They were blue in the face for saying it. And they said, but it needs to say that. And you go, hold on here. We keep on telling you that that's what it means. Those powers not delegated, they can't exercise. This is a special power of attorney. It's a limited power of attorney. And so when they created the 10th Amendment, that actually sufficed. I mean, everybody says, okay, now we've got the language that all things not delegated to this federal government are reserved to the states and the people respectively. Now, it's paraphrasing because there's a little part out there, but restricted by the states, but or to the states. But let's go into... Now we don't even have enough time. So when we come back tomorrow, we'll hit the 4th Amendment, which is the right of the people. And this one is being trampled on so heavily today with the fact that they have smart meters. They're monitoring what they can tell what kind of appliance you're running with their smart meters. They have, these are all intelligence gathering. And with AI being able to receive all of this, and most of these companies are deploying AI. And the question is, because we're seeing actually in some communities like Wyoming, where they're denying these data centers and AI computing centers. And that's a good thing because, folks, why is your utilities coming up with AI to basically monitor and gather intelligence on you? This is where the 4th Amendment really kicks in, because bottom line, if it's a corporation and it's created and sanctioned by the state, it's just another arm of the state, but it's not official. It's still governed by them, and the government can go to them and say, give us all the information you got on things. And this is how they've been skirting, especially when corporations want to share the information. And so that becomes the real problem. So we're going to dive into this, because the 4th Amendment is one of those ones that's just being trampled on big time. Folks, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, process. This is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.